And joining us right now at PMP Network is the man who sang the song, which I call the greatest love song ever written. Not only did he sing it, he wrote it, and it's called Miracles by Starship. It's a song that I have said for many, many years is probably the best love song, but he has written many, many more songs than that and has brought to us Jefferson Starship, Jefferson Airplane, and music that he continues to make. And in fact, there's a wonderful DVD out right now, Mighty Ballon Live at the Boston Esplanade from June 14, 2008, that is well worth obtaining. And also, the album Better Generation, which I have also, is a great album by Marty. And, of course, if you love Jefferson Starship, the Deep Space Virgin Sky is a one to pick up. And we welcome you right now to the program. How are you?
Hey, thank you, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, don't get electrocuted.
I'll try not to. I'm sitting here in my flooded basement.
Yeah, really.
But what can you do?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your journey in music. You were born in Ohio, and... born with a different name. Your name was not Mighty Ballon when you were born.
No. I was born under the name Buchwald.
So
we left there when I was four. Came out to California.
Yeah. So you moved to San Francisco.
Around the Bay Area, mm-hmm. You know, San Francisco mainly.
Yeah. And you were part of that 1960s San Francisco music scene?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was right in the beginning, right through it all. Saw everything, knew everybody, had fun.
But you were also, you were always an artist at the time, too, right? I mean, you've always been involved in art as well, right? Printing, art, things like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I paint and draw. I've always done that. Of course, a million people do that are in music, you know?
But you were doing some of the, like, early posters for some of the clubs out there.
Yeah, I did some of the posters. And in fact, I couldn't figure out whether I wanted to have a band and or do posters, art, or I even thought about starting a paper, you know, something like the Rolling Stone, but I didn't do it. I got in the band instead.
Well, I think you probably made a good choice.
Yeah, I like to sing, you know.
Looking back at it, I think you did pretty well. But I understand that, you know, you initially, when you were attending San Francisco State, you really did want to be a painter, but someone said that West Side Story really changed your life a little bit.
I was also a dancer as a kid, so I danced a lot, and I was lucky to dance around Frisco and I got into some pro companies, you know, the Road Company, West Side Story, and I danced Brigadoon, Guys and Dolls, things like that, you know.
Yeah.
And I was in one show when this ingenue in the show went down to L.A., and I went with her, and we went to this publishing company, and while she was talking to some guy inside, I was sitting outside in the... first room, and there was a guy playing piano working on some songs, so I just went over and I started singing along with the guy, and he goes, hey, you want to come with me? And they took me over to a recording session, and they needed a singer, because the singer dropped out or something, and it was Jimmy Haskell, who took me to a piano and asked me if I could do this, do that, and I did it, and he said, okay, let's go in this little room here with a little window, and we cut four sides, and they had, God, they had a lineup that you wouldn't believe. They had Barney Kessel on guitar. They had Glenn Campbell. He was the hot guitar player in town. Hmm. They had Jack Nietzsche on keyboards. They had Hal Blaine on drums. They had Red Callender on bass, famous jazz cat. They had the Blossoms doing backups. And they had a whole string section and Jimmy Haskell conducting and arranging. And I went in his little house and sang these songs for him. And it was the beginning of my recording career.
So 1962 is when you named yourself Marty Ballon.
Yeah, they didn't want to put my name on there, so they were trying to think of different names. We were walking along the Hollywood Boulevard looking at the stars and trying different names out, you know. And this guy who was kind of my manager had a theater called The Bow. And he said, how about Marty Ballon? I've never heard that before. Okay, and so these four sides I had done came out on Challenge Records then. They started getting played, and I started doing, you know, Legion Halls and dances and things like that. And pretty soon everybody, you know, knew me as Marty Ballon, and it just stuck.
That's it. Now, I assume that those records on Challenge Records are probably collectibles at this point, huh?
Probably, yeah. They were... They still sound pretty good, actually, you know.
Because right after that, a year later, you joined the Town Criers, right?
Yeah, I was in that folk boom that happened around the city in the, you know, the early 60s, and we toured all over and got to play with a lot of people, you know. In fact, we got to play with such great blues artists that when I started the Matrix, which was the first club for rock in Frisco, because I couldn't get any work because I was suddenly using electricity on the guitars and drums. I couldn't go back to all these places I had played as a folk musician. So I opened my own club, and out of the woodwork came, you know, everybody else from the Big Brother, Steve Miller, the Dead, you know, you name all these bands. And plus, there was comedy happening, and all the comedians came down and worked the club. And the only people I could hire were these old blues guys like Lightnin' Hopkins, Fury Lewis, John Lee Hooker, people like that. And we would back them and, you know, then get to play ourselves. And it took off. It was really cool.
Hmm. Now, so at that time, after you opened up Matrix, it wasn't that long after that that you guys formed Jefferson Airplane and Surrealistic Pillow came out and life changed.
Yeah, well, the deal was I would open a club for these guys who had the money to invest in it. And they could have the club, and I'd start a band, and I'd keep the band.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put together the band, Jefferson Airplane.
And that wasn't a bad idea, putting together Jefferson Airplane.
No, that's what I wanted to do, you know.
Now, how did you meet all the folks from Jefferson Airplane to put them together?
Well, I was, I had a hoot, you know, they used to have these hoot nannies where you'd go down and sing in these folk clubs. And I had a night one night, and I was there watching people come in and sign up to hoot. And this one guy came in, he had two axes, one a 12 and a 6, which was pretty rare, somebody having two. And they started to turn him away at the door, and I said, no, let me hear this guy, I want to hear him. I was looking for a 12-string player, because I like 12-string from the folk days. And so this guy got up and he took out his guitars, and he started to tune up, and he started to sing and play, and then he just stopped. He said, I can't do this anymore. And he walked backstage. So I ran backstage, and I said, hey, I'd like to play with you, you know. And the guy said, what? And I said, well, I mean, let's get together and try some ideas out. And I was really captivated by the 12-string. So we did that. We got together. We tried out some ideas and got along, and that was Paul Kantner.
Hmm.
And then while we were trying out one day at his house, down the stairs came this guy who had a guitar case, who was giving lessons upstairs to another guy. And I asked Paul, I said, who's that guy? And he said, oh, that's Joe McCalkin. He's a real great guitar player. I said, let's get him for our lead guitar. And he said, oh, no. That guy's much too good. I said, that's what we want, somebody really good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then from Yarma, we didn't like any of our drummers or basses. So he had known this guy who played guitar with him in Washington called Jack Cassidy, who had gone to bass playing. So we kept calling him up every night, telling him to come out, you know, that we were going to have a band and we're, you know, doing this, doing that. And he came out, and he was the bass player. And the drummer kept bugging me. I didn't like him. And one day I walked into the club in the afternoon, and there was this kid sitting there with this chick, and he was just the most beautiful-looking kid. His name was Skip Spence. And I said, hey, man, you're my drummer. And he goes, oh, no, I'm a guitar player. I said, no, you're going to be my drummer. So I gave him some sticks, and I said, take these home and practice. I'm going to call you in a couple days. So my drummer kept bugging me, and I fired him. And then I called this guy up, Skip, and he said, well, I'll give it a try. And he came, and he was great, you know. And then we had a girl, Signe Anderson, who was a singer at the folk club I was at. And Paul definitely wanted a girl in the band for the yin and the yang, so we asked her, and that started us off.
Hmm.
And the first night we played at the Matrix, I'm not kidding you, there was so much talk about this name, Jefferson Airplane, that went around the country that by the second night we played, the place was filled with record companies.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, if I remember correctly, were you guys on RCA?
Yeah, we were on RCA Victor.
Yeah. So was there a bidding war for your stuff?
Yeah, there was. We went to L.A., and And we always had a meeting with the record companies around dinner time or lunchtime so we could eat, you know. And it was great. I walked into RCA Victor and I went to meet the president, and he said, what do you want? I just off the top of my head said, well, I want $100,000. And he went, without hesitation, he says, okay, what else? And I was stupefied. I said, well, I have to come back and get back to you with that, you know, because I haven't got a manager or lawyer yet to help me out. But it was pretty funny.
Well, I mean, the first album, what was the name of the first album? Was it Jefferson Airplane?
Takes Off.
Takes Off, yeah. Did that have any singles in there that succeeded?
It's No Secret got a lot of play, and it got a lot of play on college radio. That was our first audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, the Surrealistic Pillow had Somebody to Love in White Rabbit, and forget right. that. That was in space somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, your tenor was one of the focal points of the album, but Gracie Slick as well.
Well, Grace came in, and yeah, she was like the most prettiest you could imagine, and you know, we got rid of Art Singer because she didn't want to travel, she was pregnant, and she didn't want to leave town, and we started getting bookings out of town, and we had a meeting, I remember, and I said, well, there's only two girls around, you know, there's Janis Joplin, and she's got her own thing, and that's pretty popular. And that's bluesy. And then there's Lydia Spence, and she's got her own thing, Cold Blood, and that's pretty popular and bluesy. And I said, Grace Slick, she's got her own band, and they're pretty popular because we played a lot together. And she'd probably be the only one I could really get to sing with, probably on stage, because we had similar kind of approaches, of originality, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Jack said, well, it won't hurt to ask her, so he went that afternoon and asked her, and that night she left her band and joined ours.
And history was made.
Yep.
The combination of the voices and the chemistry was huge.
Yeah, plus she brought, you know, White Rabbit, which was like a song for the time, you know. I mean, it was like perfect, you know, for the era.
Yeah, absolutely, with the psychedelic era that came out. And, yeah, Somebody to Love was huge, too. But, yeah, White Rabbit was really identified with her.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I didn't realize about some of the stuff that you actually wrote. I knew you wrote Miracles, which I still believe is the greatest love song ever written.
Oh, great.
And but I didn't know you wrote, like, Volunteers as well and Plastic Fantastic Lover and some of the other songs as well.
Yeah, I did a lot of the writing, yeah.
What was it that when you were writing, what was the thing that spurred you? Where was it? Did music come in your head? Did the lyrics come in your head? What was it that kind of was your catalyst?
We needed songs, and, you know, we just, whatever we could come up with. Sometimes I just would ask people, I say, you got a riff, you got a groove, you know, or I tell them, hey, play it something like boom, 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 you know, and, I just started making up lyrics over it, you know.
Mm. What was the relationship you had with Billy Graham, who was a legend
fantastic.
Out there?
Oh, fantastic. He was great, yeah. In fact, we were the guys who told him to, you know, put on a dance and, you know, see what happens. And he did a benefit for the mime troupe. And there were lines around the block, you know, so he said, well, hell, maybe I'll go get this place called the Old Fillmore, which was an old dance hall, and... started putting on gigs, and he was our manager for a while, and he was also cool because he would listen to the musicians, and you know, if we wanted to hear somebody or we knew something, he could go hire them, you know. Like, I was the guy who heard this record by a guy called Otis Redding called These Arms of Mine, so I took it to Bill. I said, I gotta see this guy, I want you to book this guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he did, you know, things like that. He was very open, because his thing was Latin music. He loved that Tito Puente and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when he came across Santana, he freaked out, you know, and that was really his baby.
Now, you also played some of the biggest festivals ever, Monterey, Woodstock, and, of course, the Altamont Speedway, which is known for other things. What was it like to play some of these huge things, like Woodstock, for instance, where they just had the 40th anniversary a while back?
Well, it was like awesome. I mean, it was, you know, the biggest concert going at the time, and everybody was together, and people came out, and it was like a culmination of that whole era and the feeling and the period and bringing music together with the people. And I mean, outside of all the bad stuff you can bring up, but there was this wonderful spirit that was happening, you know, that actually I believe still goes on today. It's carried on, you know.
But, you know, they've tried to replicate the spirit of Woodstock and really have not been able to do that again.
Well, how can you duplicate things like that? You know, it's like when they try to redo an old movie and try to modernize it, it doesn't happen, you know.
Mm.
I mean, if you got the magic once, it's kind of hard to do it again. You know, you have to do something else that's original.
So
I'm sure there'll be big, you know, get-togethers of music like there always is, you know.
Yeah.
Lollapaloozas and the girl thing and the, you know, the band, We Are the World thing. You know, there's always these big gathering of the musicians.
Yeah.
Just like the jazz concerts go on and on every year, and the blues festivals go on and on every year, you know.
Mm. Now, you were one of the founders, of course, of the Jefferson Airplane. What happened in 71 when you left?
Oh, it was just, you know, I don't know. It was a lot of cocaine. Well, it was a lot of people going their own way. Everybody wanting to do their own thing. And, you know, it was too big. We couldn't play for anybody. We were in these gigantic auditoriums. And it was like, you know, every time we got together to rehearse, there'd be lawyers and accountants there and telling us what to do and interrupting our rehearsal. And everybody in the band wanted to do their own thing. There was no togetherness, you know. And for me, I need the other people, you know. I'm not a solo guy. I need the other people, and I need to work with a group. And everybody else wanted to do their own thing, and, you know, that was that.
Mm.
And I just got bored, you know, because it was nobody was working together.
Of course, in your career in 81, you did have a solo album that had a couple of top 40 hits, Hearts and Atlanta Lady on your own. But I assume you were working with a band of people even then.
Well, yeah, but like I say, I like to work with people and collaborate and have a band, you know.
But you were able to have success either way, though, which is always a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, when you left Jefferson Airplane, you were with, I guess you were producing Grootna?
Well, yeah, they were friends of mine. I wasn't a producer. I was a seducer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it says on the album, seducer.
Ah.
Not producer.
Well, I read it quickly, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But, in 74, though, you kind of came back a little bit. You contributed to Jefferson Starship.
Well, I was, you know, I was watching them. They, you know, they were kind of going downhill, and they couldn't get any attention. And I figured, you know, I kept reading, you know, geez, I miss the days that Marty and Grace would sing together. And I miss the time that Paul and Marty would write, you know, and I thought, I bet you a buck they're going to come knocking on my door. And Paul did. He had this piece of music called Caroline, which I wrote Caroline. It wasn't called that. But he had this piece of music he asked me to write. And so I wrote Caroline for him. And then they went out and did it. But they came back and said, look, you know, you got to come out with it. We can't do this song without you, you know, because I had sung it on the record.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, I'll come if I can do the kind of music I want to do, you know, which was Miracles was the next thing I wanted to try. And, you know, so at first none of them liked it. They thought it was kind of weird, you know, and much too long and full of, you know, things that they didn't like the word love and baby and all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, I did it and... when it came out, boom, you know, put it back on the top.
It's interesting when you look at that song in many ways. First of all, it was on the Red Octopus album, and the long version of that song was a great song, and then they put it out as a single when they ripped off all the good lyrics that you had in there, which really aggravated the hell out of me. I couldn't stand that shortened version. I'm sure it bothered you as well.
Many people would play the short version. They all went back to the long version.
Yeah, well, some of the top 40 stations played it, and it was really annoying. But I will tell you something very interesting. When I was in the late 70s, I was teaching at Marquette University, which is a Catholic school in Milwaukee. And I taught English, and I used the song Miracles in my class. And the lyrics particularly the ones about having a taste of the real world, and you know, and the reference to a dancing inside you, actually resulted in me being called before a dean for teaching some, you know, sexually explicit lyrics in class. And I that's one of the reasons why I think that song is just an amazingly seductive tune. And I'm just wondering what inspired it and the kind of reaction you got to it when you first wrote it, before it even came out.
Well, the first reaction was like people were like shocked, you know, everybody loved it, but, you know, some people were shocked by the lyric. I don't know why. I don't say anything bad in it. I just make references and on innuendos, but the song came about actually because I had Pete Townsend had turned me on to this Mayor Baba guy one time, who was an Indian saint avatar, and that led me into another avatar, which was Sathya Sai Baba of India, and I got very involved with him, and he was the avatar, and then also I was interested in these Persian poets that would write about God, but that would write about it by making love to a woman and, you know, the breast of God and the lips of God and all that. So I kind of combined the feeling for a woman and my feeling spirituality in one song.
It flowed, flowed perfectly.
Yeah, yeah. Miracles, because Sathya Sai Baba of India does these miracles all the time.
Yeah. You also produced a singer-songwriter, Jesse Barish, who later became a songwriter for some of the songs for Starship.
Yeah. He's my best buddy, still is. And in fact, this summer, at the end of the summer, I'm going in and doing a whole album of his tunes.
That sounds like a fun time.
I finished up a new album. It'll be out soon, and I got a couple of his songs on there.
And who's that with?
Just me.
Just you, because you were saying before you like to work with other people.
Well, I worked with a bunch of people on it. I mean, yeah. I worked with Slick Aguilar, the guitar player from the Starship, and I worked with Guy Walker here, and, you know, Chris Smith, my piano player, you know, and David Truppio from New York, and, God, I had a bunch of other musicians on it, and Valerie Carter does some background singing, and it came out real good.
At one point,
I really like it when you hear it. It's got some great love songs on it, too.
Well, I'm looking forward to listening to that.
Yeah.
That'll be good. Maybe we'll talk. I'll have a talk after that comes out. But I also wanted to ask you about the time when you had the KBC band, because you and Jack and Paul got together again, away from Jefferson Starship. How did that feel when you? It was kind of like a reunion.
Well, I was working with my own band, and I had this little church we used to rehearse in San Anselmo. And Paul finally left the Starship because they were acing him out. They didn't want to do his songs. And, you know, pretty soon it was just Mickey Thomas doing everything, even the backgrounds of Grace's parts, you know. So, and they wouldn't use any of their original material. They wanted them to, you know, do all these Diane Warren songs and, you know, these songs by great writers. You know, it's the same old ripoff that companies do. So Paul finally left, and he called me up. He said, oh, I don't know what to do. And I said, well, come on up to the church. You can use my band and practice some of your music. So we rehearsed all day with my band. And then at night, after a dinner break, he would come in and we'd rehearse songs with him. And then he suddenly went and got a record contract. So we suddenly became KBC and did an album. And it was going great until one day, I don't know why, Paul and the manager called us in and said, the band's over with. Not with us. No reason, no anything. It was just over with. So don't ask me, ask Paul.
But you guys actually had a little reunion tour with Jefferson Airplane right after that, right?
Yeah, we had that 89 get together. And that was a piece of crap, too. I mean, they wouldn't let, you know, us do our own things. And, you know, they had to have other people playing it. And, I mean, it was, you know, crazy.
Well, who's they? Was that your record company?
Yeah, the record company.
That kind of sucks. You know, maybe...
They made a sucky album that didn't do anything, and that's what they got.
Yeah. It's interesting the way things have changed so much. I think the record companies have... Their power has gone way down with the, you know, with the consolidation of radio, and now the internet seems to be playing a very large part, which is kind of a big equalizer.
Yeah, the internet interweb, you know, connections and what you can do with it, and communicate directly to your audience without even going through a record company.
It's a great advantage.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it's a whole new form of getting your music to people, you know. But the only trouble is, you know, so many people can download things, too.
You know, it's interesting to note that I went over to MightyBallon.com, and it's someone else owns that.
Right.
So
there is a MightyBallon.net, though, that I started up just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I went on there, and that has some of the stuff about the DVD on it and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Joe Viglione must be helping you with that because it has a little bit of his brand on it.
Uh-huh.
So people can go to MightyBallon.net. In fact, we're going to send them there with this interview. That'll be the location we'll send them to. Now, is your wife a singer as well?
No, she's not.
No, okay. I was reading something here. It said that that your wife, Karen Deal, was a keyboardist and vocalist?
Well, she's a keyboardist, yeah. She plays keyboards. Not really a vocalist, though.
Ah, okay. Now,
if she sings good, she's not really a vocalist.
I see. Do you tour with her at all?
I did for a couple tours, yeah, in the beginning when we first met up.
How does that?
We haven't lately.
Yeah, is that something
we're
that?
We're kind of separated now, so. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I won't get into that then.
All right.
But I was wondering how, you know, going on the road, if you were doing that all the time, that can be very, it can be tough on a marriage.
Well, it can be tough on anything, you know. It's a hard thing to go on the road and, you know, put on a great show every night and travel to the next gig and break down and travel and. Yeah, it's rough, you know.
Well, it's even rough. It's rough on people who are members of the group together. It's kind of like being married.
Oh, yeah. You can be together so much, you know, you're just happy to get off the tour and say goodbye to everybody, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, like, the Beatles. I mean, they were only together for about 7 years. That was it.
Well, you know? they couldn't be heard anymore because I saw their last concert at Candlestick Park in San Francisco, and I went there and you could not hear a note they played.
Because it was too many screams, right?
Right, screaming and flashbulbs going off. It was like daylight, but you honestly could not hear a thing they did. Hmm. So, you know, I could see why they wanted to give it up.
Now, are there any plans to get Jefferson Starship / Jefferson Airplane together again for another tour?
Oh, I don't think so. You know, everybody's doing their own thing these days.
How's Gracie doing?
She does her art. You know, that's all she wants to do.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw her recently, and she didn't look like the Gracie I knew.
I saw her, too. She looked like Sydney Greenstreet, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, I didn't understand it at all. Yeah, but did you ever think that at the age you're at now that you'd even be out there making music and going out there and wanting to go do different things? I just know years ago, when I was thinking back, you know, I never envisioned myself on the radio at this age either, but... what do you think?
Well, I think it doesn't really matter, you know, because if you're an artist or a musician, you play as long as people want to hear you play.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, I would have never, you know, enjoyed and been able to see things when I was younger, like Louis Armstrong or, you know, John Coltrane and, you know, some of the great blues artists, you know, that got to work with, and I mean, I never thought about their age. I just wanted to hear their music.
Yeah.
The same with the Rolling Stones. I mean, you know, they don't really care. They're gonna play until they fall down.
Well,
why not?
I will tell you something. We're talking with Marty Balin here on PMP Network, and Marty's got a DVD out. It's called Live at the Boston Esplanade, June 14, 2008. This is a couple of years ago, and your voice is as good as it ever has been.
Thank you. I try to keep it in shape, you know.
How do you do that?
Well, I'm just a natural singer. You know, I just always been singing since I was a kid, and choirs and on the street corners and, you know, garage bands. It's just something I do. Even when I go shopping, people are always, well, you're a happy guy, you know, because I'll be humming or whistling or something. And, you know, it's just second nature to me.
The other thing that I thought was really interesting in this DVD was you got a Boston girl, Dee Dee Stewart, doing some vocals on the Gracie Classic Slicks songs.
Well, yeah, she was there in Boston, and we, you know, wanted to do those two for the crowd, so she wanted to come up and sing them, so why not?
Well, she did a nice job.
Yeah.
I thought she'd fit right in with you guys. But this, you know, all the big tracks that you'd ever want to hear are on here, from Hearts to White Rabbit to Volunteers to, of course, Miracles. It's all on Marty Balin Live at the Boston Esplanade. And if you go to MartyBalin.net, I assume there's information on there on how you can order this thing.
Right, and there'll be a new album coming out soon that'll be on there. And there are some albums on there already that I don't know if people have heard. There's the Lost Treasures album, which is a great album of tracks, which I never put out. But they're beautifully recorded and rocking out. And then there's a Nashville project I did one time with some great people. That's on there, too. You can get that.
Nashville
and
Sessions?
The new one will be out soon. It'll be on there.
Yeah, you got a bunch of them actually available there. Unfortunately, I didn't talk about them because I don't have them. So the ones that I listened to, I could hear. I mean, I really enjoyed Better Generation. I had not heard that before.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that was a funny happening, actually. That was just something. We were on tour, and they asked us to come up in New Hampshire and try this new thing called Pro Tools, you know.
Uh-huh.
But we got there, and we put down some basics, but the guy who was running it didn't really know how to run it yet, so we couldn't hear anything back in sync, or, you know, he would lose tracks, and, oh, you know, we had to get back on the road, so we just left it. And we never did finish the dang thing. We just had started, you know, sketching it out. And then they went and put it out, so...
It's actually some good music on this, though.
Yeah, but they're not done, you know. to my satisfaction.
See, I couldn't tell. I mean, you know, it sounded pretty good to me. And some of it I thought had hit music written right on it, too.
Well, when you hear this new one, I'm sure you're going to feel pretty good about it because it's done, and I've gotten to go all the way through the project to the final mixes and everything. So I'm very happy with this new one.
Well, Marty, when it comes out, we'll get together and talk with you. Maybe we can talk to Slick as well and talk about the new CD.
All right, let's do that.
And it's a pleasure talking to you, and I want to wish you a lot of luck, and stay well, and stay playing that great music.
All right, Mark, you too. Don't get shocked by that flood there.
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid the water, as I said.
Are you broadcasting from a little rowboat in the basement?
I have a little ark set up here. I've had 14 inches of rain in two storms.
Oh, God.
A little nutty.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot. Take care.
All right. Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.